Thank you very much for the special music. Nice to, wonderful to have special music. I certainly appreciate it. Enjoy it. Let's turn over to, I want to start out with Leviticus 23, but I have another theme I want to approach here as well, but I do want to mention Leviticus 23 in regard to the Day of Atonement there. I'm going to give you two lists of numbers here if you want to write some things down. First off, let's turn to Leviticus 23, verse 27. And this is where the Day of Atonement is introduced on the 10th day of this 7th month. There shall be a Day of Atonement. And what we're going to see in the next few verses down to verse 32 here is that there are seven aspects or seven points having to do with the Day of Atonement that are kind of interesting. So I'll read them, even though they were, I think we read them in the sermonette here, or read some of these verses there as well. But I want to mention these seven items as we go. So I won't read all of these verse by verse here, but I'll point them out to you. First of all, it says, it shall be a Day of Atonement. It shall be an holy convocation to you. So we know seven things about the Day of Unleavened Bread, the Day of Atonement from these verses in particular. And the first one is that it's a holy convocation, or it is a commanded assembly, is another way of saying that, that this is an opportunity for us to come before God. And he says to come before him on these days. That means they're a convocation is a commanded assembly. The second point here is you shall afflict your souls. So we have a second point, obviously afflicting your souls, and that is something that is identified throughout Scripture basically as the concept of fasting, going without food and water. And that's typically what it is throughout the Scriptures. And then we also have a third one. It says an offering shall be made by fire to the Lord. So there's a third aspect to the day that there is an offering to be taken up as well. And we do that not so much in terms of killing animals today. We do that in terms of taking up an offering to give to God and his work and the things that he's doing on this earth. So we take up a financial offering. And let's see. Number three was the offering. Number four, you shall do no work in that same day. You shall do no work in that same day. So this is a day that we do not work on, or we do not go to work for. It's a day of atonement, to make an atonement for you before the Lord your God. And then point number five, or step number five here, is down in verse 31. It says, you shall do no manner of work. It shall be a statute forever. So the Day of Atonement is something that is to be kept forever. It is an eternal process of what God is doing, or part of what God is doing with mankind. So as long as we are physical human beings, this Day of Atonement is to be kept. That's basically what we're talking about here. Point number six is in verse 32. It says, it shall be to you a Sabbath of rest. So it is to be a Sabbath of rest. We are not to work on that day. It is a day that we relax, or try to not do the strenuous things of the usual things that we do during the days of the week. And then number seven is also in verse 32. Toward the end of the verse here, it says, from even unto even shall you celebrate your Sabbath. So there's a seventh aspect of when this day is to be kept. And we find that's also applicable to all of the holy days, not just the Day of Atonement. So there's seven points or seven aspects to the day that are given to us here. But nonetheless, even in those seven aspects, we still don't know why we keep the Day of Atonement, do we? Well, let me give you a few purposes of the Day of Atonement, and then we'll talk about from the Bible why. Are one of the most important ones, I think, that we'll talk about in the theme here today. First of all, the purpose, there are seven or eight purposes that I can come up with. There are probably more, but if you want to list them for the Day of Atonement, you can. First of all, this day reflects Christ as a sacrifice. That's one of the purposes of the Day of Atonement, is it reflects Christ as the perfect sacrifice. Secondly, it reflects freedom from sin. The process of expiation that occurs as Christ's sacrifice is applied to us. A freedom from sin. Thirdly, there is a freedom from Satan, and of course he's in the process of he's going to be in the process of being removed when Jesus Christ returns and the final day of atonement there before as the millennium begins. Maybe not the final day of atonement, but that day of atonement or that time frame as Christ returns, he's going to remove Satan as well. So there is freedom from him. He's going to be taken away because his influence is a bad one in terms of the meaning of this day. The meaning of this day can't be accomplished with him around. Point number four is it is a release from slavery. We find that the Day of Atonement is a release from slavery. Slaves were released on the Day of Atonement in the seventh year in ancient Israel. There are a lot of things that were done on the Day of Atonement as well. Number five, it is the beginning or marks the beginning of a Jubilee year or a sabbatical year, either one. Day of Atonement is the day that those begin on. The trumpets are blown several days before atonement on trumpets, but then the Day of Atonement is actually when the official point at which those things begin to occur. Point number six, I'm reading really small print in my margin here. There's a certain symbolism that comes with the day. And that symbolism, of course, is our high priest, Jesus Christ, and he is our intercessor, so we find him pictured in this day as well, what he does. The symbolism of all that he has done as high priest is really what this day is about. Also, number seven is making God's people holy. That's what God is in the process of doing. He's making his people holy. And this day symbolizes that. The eighth purpose I've listed here is probably the most important, which is the theme of the day, which is reconciliation. Reconciliation with our fellow man, but reconciliation primarily with God. That's what really the day is all about, both in the past, the present, and the future. There will be reconciliation. So I wanted to mention those in particular, just so you have those two lists to kind of help you see a little bit more of a specific picture regarding the Day of Atonement and some of its purposes, because Leviticus, as you can see, lists seven functions or seven important points having to do with atonement, but it doesn't really tell you very much about why. Those points, I think, kind of help you understand a little bit more about the why. Now I want to take you on a journey back into time a little bit, say 100 years perhaps ago, during the period of time in which the British Empire was at its peak and England ruled the waves and the sun never set on the British Empire. I'll kind of put you in the mood here. We could play their national anthem here, but we'll skip that. And we'll take us back in the empire a little bit in time. For instance, to one of the countries of the empire. We're going to go to India. And we would find in India that there was a very distinct separation between the peoples of India and British citizens. So if you were an Indian citizen and a British citizen, the Indian citizen was still treated as though they were a second-class citizen in India during those days. Even if you were well-educated and an Indian citizen and you were well-known and maybe friend of the Raja, you know, I mean, you could be anybody important, but you were still never allowed to be equal with a British citizen. It just wasn't done. You weren't treated that way with great respect. Unfortunately, that took place not only in the British Empire, but in many empires throughout time. People have been prejudiced against other people of other races or other groups. And there was always a partition or a separation between those peoples. I want to read you a story from those days. During that particular time, the Prince of Wales came to visit India. Not the current one. This is way back during this period of time in the British Empire. And he came to visit the capital city of India, which at the time was New Delhi, and a formidable barrier had been set up to prevent the people from getting anywhere near the Prince of Wales when he came to visit. And it kept the masses of people way back off at a distance, so they could only really get a glimpse of the royalty as it came through. And when the prince arrived, he was presented with various dignitaries, and they shook hands, and he greeted them, and, you know, there was a certain pause for a moment while he looked over the shoulders of the dignitaries into the crowds and realized that there were barriers out there that were keeping people from getting anywhere near him. And he very quickly responded and said, "Take those barriers down." And so they very quickly responded to the prince and decided they better get the barriers taken down very quickly. So they did. They were quickly removed, and people of all ranks and social levels within the Indian Empire were able to mix and mingle and to greet and to say hello to the prince. Sometime later, number of years later, I think, when he was no longer prince, but the king, came back to India to visit again. And there was a sign over a huge crowd of people. And the sign said, "The Prince of Outcasts." And the people were holding up the sign because they remembered him as being one who mixed with them, who spent time with them. There was once a very closeness and solidarity between the royalty, the subjects of the empire, and the royalty or the royal throne of Great Britain, and they did mix and mingle with their people. Then there was a period of time in which they didn't again, and then a period of time more recently when they have. But that has gone on through the centuries in all kinds of nations, and we've seen difficulties today with the same kind of thing occurring in our country and other countries. There are countries all around the world that have problems with interracial hatred and anger with each other, and countries splitting in half and declaring themselves independent in order to be separate from another group of people. Those kinds of things happen today all the time. Something or someone besides the Prince of Wales, though, this reminds me of something. You know, when you think about what this story about the Prince of Wales, who does it remind you of? Does it remind you of someone else that we read about in the scriptures from time to time? Someone who will ultimately sit on the same throne as the Prince of Wales. But this prince is called the Prince of Peace, Jesus Christ. And he is the one who's, by his death, has broken down the middle wall or the barrier between us and God, and the barrier between one human being and another as well. Let's go over to Ephesians, the first two chapters of Ephesians. The Apostle Paul tackles this prejudice, racial prejudice, if you want to put it that way. He talks about it here in these first two chapters of Ephesians, but Ephesians 2:14 in particular. He says, "For he himself is our peace, who has made both one and has broken down the middle wall of separation," or the middle wall of partition, I think it says in the King James. Christ broke down the barrier of sin and its penalty of death that stands between us and God. The fact that Indian citizens were treated really like second-class citizens by many people and by many of the British subjects and even by some of its governors and leading figures is just one of many such incidences that have occurred throughout history. sometimes between Israelite and Gentile, sometimes between one Gentile and another, sometimes between Gentile and Israelite. It has occurred many times. And the same was true in Jesus' day when Jews and Gentiles tended to be prejudiced against each other. And in Paul's day as well. And Paul writes about it in particular in these two chapters of Ephesians. The Pharisees in Paul's day, and even the Pharisees that had been called and had become a part of the Jerusalem Church of God, were used to their particular form of Jewish segregation, I guess is what we'd call it. There was a system of segregation that the Jews had in their dealings with the Gentiles. They didn't want to touch them. They didn't want to go in their homes. They didn't want to have anything to do with them. They wanted to be separate from them, and Jews just simply did not have dealings with Gentiles, and vice versa. Within the temple in Jerusalem, there were courts for Israel, and there was also a court for the Gentiles. It was separated by a barrier that was constructed in the second temple. Some people would say the third temple was really the second temple, even though it had been torn apart, torn down, and had to be rebuilt again, but it was really still the second temple. The first one, of course, you have the tabernacle, and then there was the Temple of Solomon, and then the temple was rebuilt by Nehemiah, but then it was torn down again, and it was rebuilt again by Herod. So this is still the second temple, even though it kind of sounds like the third temple. Anyway, none of those previous temples or tabernacles had a wall of partition between Israelite and Gentile. Only Herod's temple did they actually put up a stone wall between the two courts to separate Israel from the Gentiles. In Paul's day, Gentiles who wished to become proselytes were allowed into the outer court, or what was called the court of the Gentiles. But even then, they had to go through a system of ritual, and they had to go through various purifications and regimentation in order to become a proselyte. But even after circumcision and baptism, they were never allowed to fully participate in the way that the Jews, or one of Israelite birth, was allowed to do. Under the strict Jewish system of Gentile proselyte, or a Gentile proselyte could simply not be equal with a Jew in terms of approaching God. And the Jews saw to that, and they wanted it that way, and they wanted to keep them in their place. Even after all the strict ceremony and all of those things, they were not able to ever be equal with the Jews or with those of Israel. And that was something that God never intended from the beginning. But unfortunately, during the construction of Herod's temple, among a number of the persuasive Jews of the day, they were able to convince him that they needed a wall of partition between the two courts so that Israel wouldn't mix with the Gentiles. God wanted the Gentiles who lived among the Israelites to be equal in all things. That word Gentile in the Greek in the New Testament is the word ethnos, from which we get the word ethnic in English. Just a little tidbit there. Let's go back over to the Old Testament. I want to take a look at Exodus here in a minute and go to Exodus chapter 12. There's some interesting information in Exodus chapter 12 that helps us to understand a little bit about what God had in mind rather than what men sometimes have in mind in terms of the relationships between one race and one group of people and another. The Gentile living in Paul's day faced the predicament of never being quite equal to his Jewish element, or to the equivalent Jewish element within Judaism, or even within the Church of God, because many of the Pharisees and others who came into the church still wanted to keep the Gentiles kind of back and away and in their place, and prevent them from truly having the aspect and social aspect of worshiping with them. In worshiping God. They didn't want the Gentiles to forget that they were not originally the people of God. So there was an attempt to constantly keep them in a box, so to speak, and keep them away from maybe having the same reward or being equal in their sight. And the first two chapters of Ephesians deal with this issue in particular, and we find Paul addressing it here. When God first began revealing his feast days and his way of life to ancient Israel, he made provision for those who were not Israelites. And that's what I want to look at here in Exodus chapter 12, because God gives us the instructions on how to make someone who's not an Israelite eligible to partake of the Passover and to become part of the covenant people and to have all the same privileges that the Israelites could have. And he mentions it here in Exodus chapter 12, beginning in verse 43. And the Lord said unto Moses and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover. There shall no stranger eat thereof. Now, of course, foreigners, strangers, Gentiles, whatever you want to call them, they're referred to as strangers here, at least in the King James Version. That's what they were called. But every man's servant that is bought for money, when you have circumcised him, then shall he eat thereof. In other words, he could be eligible to partake of the Passover if he was circumcised. Verse 45, a foreigner and a hired servant shall not eat thereof. In one house shall it be eaten, and you shall not carry forth aught of the flesh abroad out of the house, neither shall you break a bone thereof. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it, and when a stranger shall sojourn, in verse 48, with you, and will keep the Passover, or has a desire to keep the Passover with you, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near and keep it, and he shall be as one that is born in the land. No longer any distinction. For no uncircumcised person shall eat thereof. One law shall be to him that is homeborn and unto the stranger that sojourns among you. Everything is going to be equal. Once they are circumcised, they may join the ranks of the Israelite and be fully recognized by God. No longer do they have to be kept in their place, as the Jews would try to do with the Gentiles. Yet Christ came to do something about this very thing, and we find it in the book of Ephesians again. So let's go back to Ephesians. We've just looked at Exodus, and we've looked at what the concept of partaking of the covenant and being part of Israel meant in the Old Testament. Now let's take a look at what is said in the New Testament in this regard. If I can find it here, there we go. Ephesians chapter 2, let's begin in verse 11. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 11. Therefore remember that you, once Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by what is called the circumcision, made in the flesh by hands, that at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now, in Christ Jesus, you who once were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ, for he himself is our peace, who has made both one and has broken down the middle wall of separation, having abolished in his flesh the enmity or the hatred, that is, the law of commandments and ordinances, so as to create in himself one new man from the two, thus making peace. Tremendous statement that Paul makes in terms of peace between races and peoples. Paul knew and understood that the Gentiles could share in the process of salvation without having to become part of the covenant community through circumcision. It was not necessary to be circumcised, and the new covenant makes that quite plain. And he knew that Christ's sacrifice provided equality for Jew and Gentile, and that it broke down the middle wall of partition between the Jew and the Gentile. The partition between the court of the Gentiles and the court of Israel was called that middle wall of partition. And Paul writes about it here in Ephesians because he was highly offended by it. And if we examine the structure of the temple at Jerusalem then, In Paul's day, it was Herod's temple, and that was a physical wall that was actually constructed. And there was a sign on the physical wall that basically said that if you were not an Israelite, were not circumcised and recognized or whatever, you could not go in there. And if you went in there, there was a death sentence, and it clearly said that in several languages that the Romans allowed them to put up. And the Romans didn't even object too much. They did not like Judah or the Sanhedrin having the power of life and death, but they also recognized that there was a lot of racial and religious upset regarding this wall, and that if people went into it who were not circumcised or were Gentiles, and went beyond the wall, into the area where Israel was, there was a death sentence, basically, to go in there. And they would kill people for doing it. Sometimes they would kill them right on the spot. People would pick up stones and kill them right there. There wasn't an awful lot of question. You know, if you were caught in that area at that time, and they knew you were uncircumcised, and they'd pull your pants down and double-check right there on the spot, and that was it. You were stoned to death on the spot, if that was the case. The Romans didn't like that very much, but there wasn't a lot they could do about it, and as long as it kept general peace, even though there wasn't much peace right there at the moment, they accepted it and allowed it to occur, and usually there was not much retribution by the Romans. They just simply realized that, well, we better put a sign up because there's going to be violence if somebody accidentally crosses over that line, so they need to be warned. Now, at the time that they constructed a special wall of requirement, or what do I want to call it, a special wall of requirements, it was a special wall, but it was also a spiritual requirement here when they did this. They were beginning to put together ordinances and ceremonies to keep the Gentiles from becoming Jews or from becoming Israelite. That was part of it, and part of the interpretation here of what we're looking at, too, of what we've just talked about. Let me go back and look. Again, one of the things that I think Paul is dealing with here in Ephesians 2 is the fact that Christ has died to make us one, or to bring us together, if you want to put it that way. And that was something that separated us. In Ephesians 2:14 that we just looked at, Christ came down to break down that middle wall. We've talked about that. So that the Jews could be Christ did this so that the Jews could be reconciled to the Gentiles, and that together as one man in Christ, they would be reconciled to God. It was a process that Jesus went through, and in his sacrifice and his atonement sacrifice, we find that there is now a unity, or can be a unity, between them, and that they can all be brought before God. And that's part of what the Day of Atonement is really all about, is reconciliation. To bring people together, but also to bring people before God, or to bring and to reconcile human beings with their God. And just as the British mistreated, of course, the citizens of India as second-class citizens, we as a nation and other nations, we as a nation, the United States, certainly mistreated black peoples after the, or at least up until the time at which slavery was abolished, and even treated them as second-class citizens in many ways thereafter. In every country, there has been some of this racial or religious or whatever kind of prejudice between people. And there is coming a time when Israel will be oppressed by other people. You know, we've done some of the oppressing ourselves, but someday there is going to come a time where we will be oppressed by the Gentiles as well. Let's go over to Isaiah, because it mentions it here. Isaiah chapter 3. I really shouldn't quote too much from Isaiah right before the feast, because you're probably going to hear a lot of quotes from Isaiah at the feast here. Isaiah chapter 3, verses 4 and 5. And it says, I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. There is a coming problem in our nation And the peoples shall be oppressed, every one by another, and every one by his neighbor. The child shall behave himself proudly against the ancient, and the base against the honorable. There'll be age prejudices, there will be race prejudices, there will be religious prejudices of all kinds that are coming in the future. Christ came to put a stop to people oppressing each other, to save the outcasts. That job won't be fully completed until he returns the second time. But God has all peoples equal in his sight, and it is his intent that they be reconciled to him. And that's what the primary reason that Jesus Christ came. If atonement itself is understood fully and taught completely, there's no need to have what some people were looking for a number of years ago, a racial or reconciliation day in the church. People seem to want to have that at one time. I almost laughed when I heard that people decided they really wanted to have a church reconciliation day, and I was thinking, what do you think atonement is? But that's been a number of years since that occurred. But that's what this day is. It is a day of reconciliation. Reconciliation with each other and with God. There was a time when a reconciliation day was a popular idea, but today is that day. We don't need a Martin Luther King Day in the church either. We don't need that because today is it. Today is the day. And if you hold any obligation or objection against your brother, today is the day to get rid of them. Today is the day to settle them. Notice the atonement theme of what Paul says in Romans chapter 5. Let's go over there and look at Romans 5 for a moment. There's a number of verses right in a row here in Romans 5, beginning with verse 8, that talk about the subject of atonement and reconciliation. I'm going to read them. Romans 5, verse 8, "But God demonstrates his own love toward us, in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." While we were still separate, while we were still the outcasts, while we were still different than what God would have us be, Christ died for us. "Much more then, having now been justified by his blood, we shall be saved from wrath through him. We will be brought into the covenant people and saved by him." For, and his covenant of the New Testament and his blood. "For if, when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his Son, much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. And not only that, but we also rejoice in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have now received the reconciliation." That last word there, reconciliation, it speaks of Christ's sacrifice for everyone now, not just one sinner, but all sinners. And that last word there, reconcile, at the end of the sentence in verse 11, receive the reconciliation. That reconciliation word is katalogin. Katalogin, and that word in Greek can be translated as either reconciliation, restoration, or atonement. All three of those words are part of the definition of that Greek word. So you could easily put any one of those words in here. So if you're looking for the concept of atonement in the book of Romans, it's right here. Same word. But of course, sometimes translators don't like to use the word atonement because that might imply a holy day, and we don't want to confuse people with that kind of thing, so we'll not use the word. We have received the reconciliation in the atonement that Jesus Christ made to God. Which brings us to the question, should we not also be reconciled to our brothers and sisters? Yes, indeed we should. Christ commanded us to do so in Matthew chapter 5. Well, verse 24, I'm going to cut right into a big subject here, but the verse itself actually is what I'm looking for. Verse 24, He says, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. It's God's desire that we be reconciled. There's anything that we have between people. And if we look at the festivals of God as a whole, we see that they are a reflection of Jesus Christ. Big surprise? No, not a big surprise at all. But that's what they are. They're a reflection of Him and what He has done, what He is doing, and what He is about to do in the future. And that's basically the theme of the Holy Days. They reflect God's plan, what's being done, and what Jesus Christ has done along the way and continues to do along the way in that plan for mankind, the plan of salvation. Even salvation itself is a process of reconciling people with God. And I can see why reconciliation is such an important concept in the Day of Atonement. All of us were before our calling, and all of mankind before its calling were outcasts. People who knew not God. People who had no knowledge of their God and what He's doing. And people who have not known God but have rejected or have been rejected by other people. Even people who known God who've been rejected by people around them. People who treated other people with prejudice, even among Christians. Was not, or it has not been at least the least bit uncommon historically for so-called Christians to mistreat one another. Happens all the time historically. We as God's people have had thousands of years of such treatment. Thankful in our day and age, it's a relative period of peace. There's not much persecution. A little here and there, yes, you know, from your boss to get off of the feast or taking your kids out of school for the feast and that kind of thing. Sometimes we get a little flack about it, and it can be difficult. Sometimes we get hauled into court by people over issues like that. And we're still trying to learn how to properly treat one another, even in the church today. Even ancient Israel, the people of God, picked out to be His very own people, to be the first whom He would work with, didn't know, didn't understand, and couldn't fully appreciate what it was that God was doing. They were not a called out and converted people. Yet in all the experiences that we see Israel having in the Old Testament, and all the things they endured, and all the recorded events that we find in the Old Testament, we find a constant reflection of what God was doing and what God was yet to do. The feast days are always a time of rejuvenation and reconciliation with God, and that was their purpose for ancient Israel, and that's part of their primary purpose for us today as well. A time to bring us closer to God. And in the future, all Israel and Judah will be outcasts, will be scattered, will be taken into captivity, and will become slaves and second or third or fourth class citizens to the Gentiles in very difficult times in the future. The same will be true for many of the New Testament people of God, unfortunately. Certainly those that are classified as Laodicean. Not a good outcome. Let's go to Isaiah for a moment. Isaiah chapter 11. I have to just quit using Isaiah. I'm always going to Isaiah. All right. Chapter 11, and let's begin in verse 11. Isaiah just sometimes makes things so plain. Isaiah chapter 11 and verse 11. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set His hand again the second time to recover the remnant of His people. This is talking about in the future, to bring us back from captivity, which shall be left from Assyria, from the Egyptian, from Pathros, and from Cush, and from Elam, and from Shinar, and from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. And He shall set up an ensign for the nations, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel. If you're looking for a title of the sermon. You can call it the Day of Atonement, a time for outcasts, if you're looking for a name. And gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. The envy also of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not vex Ephraim. This is a millennial prophecy of a time after Christ's second coming. And here in Isaiah, we see the prophecy of reconciliation and recovery of Israel and Judah from their captors, and even the reconciliation of the enmity, of the hatred that has gone on between them and between the tribes and the nations. But mainly, we're seeing a reconciliation of Israel and Judah with their God. But it also pictures a spiritual reconciliation of all peoples. Isaiah could say a lot in a very small mouthful, so to speak. Let me quote to you something else a church historian said not too long ago, one of the church's leaders many years ago. He said, "It was never recorded alone that the children of Israel came back to God and really sought him when we look at the history of the divided monarchy," which is basically the looking at the difference between Judah and Israel, "without," I'm quoting him now, "without recognizing the festivals are involved." The festivals were always a part of the reconciliation process, particularly the Day of Atonement, but all of them. One of the greatest lessons that the Old Testament has to offer is that the festivals of God were always a key to or a vital part of Israel and Judah whenever they wanted to return to their God. And this historian demonstrated that in every case we have recorded in the scriptures without fail. When Israel or Judah was coming back to their God or being reconciled to him, the feast days were involved in the process. Some of you will remember who said that. It was Dr. Hay in a sermon he gave on September the 16th, 1977. I wrote it down. It was a tremendous quote. Every time Israel or Judah, one of their kings or any of the leadership, decided they wanted to come back to God, the festivals were involved. What does that tell you about the festivals? They're key to reconciling with God. And that's why they're so important for us to go to and to attend and to be part of. Perhaps we can begin to see their importance today. I remember Dr. Hay, this is one of the great quotes that he gave. I remember sitting in his class. I remember taking things from him in college and thinking, you know, I always enjoyed his sermons because he always had something unique that I'd never heard before, never understood before. The only thing I didn't like about Dr. Hay was when I was actually in his class in college, he loved to make you read books, and he'd walk into class with a stack of books about like this, and he'd set them down on the lectern, and we would all just, oh, no, because we knew what he was going to do. And he was going to go through, and he would give you the title to the book, and then he'd tell you who the author was, and it's in the college library. Go pick up this book and read through it sometime between now and the final exam. And then he would go through the next book, and he'd go through the next one, and go through the next one. And somebody in the class would inevitably raise their hand and say, "Are there any questions on the final exam from any of those books?" And he would say, "Yes," and go on. So you were left with having to read a huge amount if you were in Dr. Hay's class, but that was just simply the way it was. You got used to it. And then you tried to get out of his class as quickly as you could, and not take any more of his classes as quickly as you could in college. Now, he was extremely informative. I'm sure I would enjoy it much more today than I did when I was 20 or 21 in school. But I think you can perhaps begin to see some of the importance of this concept of reconciliation, especially in regard to our reconciliation with God as a church and as individuals as well. That's part of what this day is about. They play a tremendous part in reconciliation. And ultimately, when we look at Passover, the Days of Unleavened Bread, Pentecost, the Feast of Tabernacles, Last Great Day, all of the feast days, as we look at all of them, they all focus on what Jesus Christ has done, is doing, and will do in the future. And that's exactly, basically, what the theme of the feast days is as well, isn't it? So why wouldn't they be one and the same or similar in that meaning? All the feast days reflect now and back then to Israel the process of reconciliation with God. That's what they are. A chance for people of God, whether Old Testament Israel or New Testament Church of God, to be reconciled with one another and with God. And they're a vital part of our seeking reconciliation to God through Jesus Christ, even today. The feast days have always played a dynamic part in God's bringing his people back to himself. That's what he ultimately wants. In going through the sacrifices not long ago and teaching them at ABC, I began to see some fantastic parallels with the sacrifices and God wanting to be with his people and wanting to spend time with them. And I think I mentioned it in Trumpets. Maybe I didn't. The Trumpets sermon, I don't know whether I mentioned the particular piece of meat that God took in the peace offerings. I think maybe I did mention it, maybe I didn't. In the peace offerings, there are three peace offerings. Actually, there's six blood sacrifices. Well, I'm going to explain it that way. There's six blood sacrifices. There is the burnt offering. There is the sin offering, the trespass offering. And then there are three more that are all peace offerings, but each one of them is called something different. I think one of them is free will, one of them is votive, and one is, and I'm going to stall on the very last one. I don't remember what the sixth one is, but there's votive, free will, and thank offerings. So there's a thank offering, votive, and free will. All three of those, none of the first three, does God actually take a portion of the meat. He takes the fat, the caul, which is actually a fatty layer that overlaid the liver in an animal, and he took the kidneys, and he took the skin. And all those were burned, basically, or burned completely. The rest of the animal then was then used, depending on whether it was a sin offering or it wasn't, one of the classifications of the offering. But he never took any portion of the meat that we would consider really appetizing or edible or something that we would want to have until the peace offering. In the peace offering, God takes a piece of what we would call the rump or the flank. Now, we think about that. That doesn't sound very appetizing, but actually it is. If you've ever had flank steak done well, like we did up in New York, an elder cooked it on his backyard barbecue, and it was some of the best steak I think I've ever eaten in my life. It was really good, as I recall. But God took that portion, and you can find this in Leviticus 3, verse 9. God took that portion as part of the peace offering because he wanted to share the meal with Israel. But Israel was so bound up in its own sins that God couldn't really come among them and share the meal with them. It's interesting because the peace offerings, all of the offerings where there was food that could be taken from the sacrifice and shared, was shared between the priest who did the offering, his family, and the person, the offerer, who brought the animal forward, and his family. They could all eat it, but they had to eat it within the confines of the temple or the confines of the tabernacle itself. It had to be eaten in the court. Why? Why would God demand that the food was eaten within the court? Who's there in the court, in the temple, in the tabernacle? God. He wanted to sit down and fellowship and share with his people. But because of their sins, he was unable to do so. Now, all of that looks forward to the future. The Jews, in their Seder Passover meal, they hold a chair aside for Elijah to eat with them, the Elijah to come. Now, why would they do that? Because Elijah doesn't want anything to eat? No, because Elijah is, as they see it in prophecy, that he's going to join them and he's going to eat with them. What do we look forward to in terms of a meal in the future? The marriage supper, when God will sit down and eat with us and fellowship with us. That's his desire. That's what he desires to. That's, in a way, that's kind of reflected in the Feast of Tabernacles. I'm going to talk about that a little bit in the feast sermon too. I don't want to get them all mixed up here, because I'm kind of jumping into a little bit of what I'm going to talk about at the feast too. But the feast days have always played a dynamic part in our return or our reconciliation or being brought back to God. Just as the Sabbath is a shadow of our relationship, the feast days are also a shadow. The Sabbath is a shadow of our relationship with God and with the millennial rest of Christ's reign. Just like the bread and the wine at Passover are, you know, those are shadows of Christ, and we treat them as vitally important, don't we? It's not like shadows aren't important, just as we would not often think of the fact that we would be willing to miss the bread and wine at Passover a year. We do everything in our power to make sure that we get to Passover every year, don't we? Well, some of these other symbols and shadows are just as important. And the Day of Atonement is a shadow of our ultimate reconciliation with God. Also extremely important. And it's just like we should think about the holy days and that we should not think about missing any one of them as well. And just like baptism is a mere ceremony and it's a shadow or a figure of what God is doing in us right now, everyone must be baptized. And these things are just shadows, but vitally important shadows. The feast days are also just a vital shadow in the same way. A shadow of what Christ has done, a shadow of what Christ is doing, a shadow of what he's about to do in the future. There are shadows of reconciliation with God. There's all kinds of shadows that run through the holy days. And we must keep them all. And the shadow is to focus us on our need for relationship with God. Without them, we as physical human beings tend to forget who we are and who God is and what he's doing. And that's why the feast days come so often in the year to remind us of who God is and what he's doing and what our part in his plan is. And what our true priorities in life ought to be. The feast days are a time when we reflect away from ourselves and toward God. And in the process of reflecting upon him, we better our relationship with him. And that's one of the reasons God gave us the festivals. We just kept the Feast of Trumpets, and we should all be aware of the future perspective of the Day of Trumpets and understanding it. A day picturing the return of Christ to this earth, but before that time will come, there's going to be some pretty terrible prophecies that have to be fulfilled. Some terrible things that have to take place. And Jesus Christ described them in Matthew 24, and he talked about some of the terrible things to come. He said, "For many shall come in my name, saying," and you're familiar with some of these things I'm going to quote, "and shall deceive many. And then they shall deliver you up to be afflicted." That's another one that he talks about. "And many shall be offended and shall betray one another and shall hate one another." Those things that aren't reconciliatory, I guess if that's a word, are going to be coming in the future. "And many shall be offended and shall betray one another and shall hate one another. Then shall be great tribulation. And they shall put you out of the synagogues." And on it goes. "The time cometh when whosoever kills you will think that he does God's service." It's not a very fun time immediately before Christ returns. Many of these things have already begun to occur. So I don't know of anybody who's necessarily lost their life as yet for their belief and faith in this age. But That time probably is coming. And as we look at the future day of trumpets and all the hatred and the evil that manifests itself in the world, you know, I really wonder, shortly before Christ comes and his return, the importance of atonement and its meaning becomes far greater to us. The atonement, the reconciliation with him, the importance of reconciliation with all men, and ultimately to God. That all the men doing terrible things to one another, both Christian and non-Christian, that we see in the world, will be reconciled to God and to each other, and at the time frame immediately after his return. That's a wonderful time to look forward to. A wonderful thing. And we're headed into difficult times ahead before Christ returns. Times with which you and I will become outcasts from society, will be rejected for many reasons. Society looks at us, and as it continues to plunge down the slope of moral decay and get worse and worse, they compare themselves with us and the things that we do, and they become more hateful and more angry at us for the things that we do and the practices we live by. Look at our practices from a biblical perspective. They are what God commands, but how many people in mainstream Christianity would be favorable to many of the things that we do today? For instance, the feast days. You're a terrible parent taking your child out of school for, what it is, 8 days, 9 days, or 10 days. What a terrible parent you are. They wouldn't look very favorably on that. One day those will be viewed as heretical things that we're doing as a church. From a Protestant or Catholic perspective, how about Sabbath keeping? There are a lot of ways you can look at the Sabbath, and we may find that one day we'll be rejected from the workforce entirely because of our perspective of the Sabbath. We may find that we're considered to be disloyal Americans because we won't work to help the economy on the Sabbath. We are disloyal Americans. Or maybe they won't call us Americans anymore because we're disloyal to the concept of working on the Sabbath. Disloyal Americans because we won't help the economy out. Or that we're heretics who are Judaizing instead of obeying the accepted practices of the church. What about child rearing? How will the government view parents who refuse to have their children indoctrinated in the theory of evolution? Or refuse to back up the school and its teaching of it? Or indoctrinated in how it is proper to have two people of the same sex marry and as parents? Those are hate crimes. We already have laws in Canada that I can't speak about things like that up there, or I can be put in jail. Hate crime to even talk about it. How about corporal punishment? What terrible people, human beings, would do that to their children? What about refusing jury duty service? What kind of a citizen are you? How can you possibly refuse to serve on a jury in this country? How can you keep your children from keeping Christmas? What a terrible thing. A lot of those things may be coming in the future. How can you as a church say that other Christians are not saved? What bias, what prejudice, what egotistical attitude you could possibly have to say that your group is the only called out group in the world? That the Church of God composes only the people with God's Spirit. How terrible can you say things like that? If we sat down and thought about it, we could compile quite a list of things that would be considered very offensive and maybe in the near future illegal for us to be doing, with morals and legislature going further and further down a decline and slide. What might surprise us how many things we could be arrested for in the future or fined for taking out our kids out of school for the feast. Could probably end up in jail for that one of these days. All people on this earth who've been fighting and squabbling with each other and at war with each other are going to be reconciled with Jesus Christ after his return to this earth. And that's what this day is about. Satan will have to be removed because he's the biggest impediment to that happening that we can imagine. He has provoked man to go away from God on every occasion and every opportunity throughout history. So he has to be locked up. He has to be put away. Otherwise, reconciliation with God is just not going to occur. You know, we look at what he's provoked on this earth and all the anger and the hatred and the resentment between one nation and another. You know, we could go down and list all of the latest wars and things that have happened in the recent past and realize how badly this earth needs to be reconciled to God. We can go and we can even look at within the church itself some of the reconciliation that's needed. Sadly, in 1995, what we could say is the ship of state, the ship of the church, so to speak, went down like the Titanic in the cold waters of the North Atlantic. Many people jumped into the ocean. Some were able to get into life rafts of various churches of God. Some were not. And they swam around from one life raft to another, from one group to another. People tried this group, this church of God, and that church of God, and another church of God, and maybe they hung on for a while, and then they dissolved, and then they had to look somewhere else, and there were people who didn't go anywhere and just were swimming around in the icy waters of the North Atlantic. How long do you think they'll last? That's one of the reasons we have the broadcast going out. That's one of the reasons we have the Kingdom of God seminars, to reach out to people and to reconcile so many people who've been called, who've been part of the church at one time or another and are going nowhere now. Or maybe they're just hopping from life raft to life raft, looking, and can't find what they're looking for. We can no longer be concerned with the safety of the ship itself. We have to be concerned with the survival of God's people who are swimming around in that cold, icy water out there, going nowhere. All these survivors are outcasts, too. But there will be reconciliation. There will be oneness. There will be unity again among God's people. And then they will all be God's people, as we use the term today, because God will begin working with all peoples. Let's turn over to Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 31. Some of my favorite verses in the Bible. Jeremiah 31, let's look at verse 34 in particular. It says, "And they shall teach no more every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord. For they shall all know me, from the least of them unto the greatest of them, saith the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more." What a promise. These days are coming right after Jesus Christ returns. And the Day of Atonement reflects the meaning of these times of reconciliation to come in the millennium of Christ's rule. We all need to view the Day of Atonement as a special day, reflecting our future and the future of all mankind and its relationship with God. And especially a time of bringing all the outcasts of mankind together in one government and under one governor. Isaiah chapter 9. Can't help it, I got to go back there one more time. Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6. Isaiah 9 and verse 6. It said, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. The government will be upon his shoulder, and the coming kingdom of God is going to rest upon him. A time of joy and rebuilding, a time of reconciliation and bringing of all people back into oneness in Jesus Christ. And that's the ultimate meaning and the purpose and the focus of the Day of Atonement for us today. That's what it's really all about, to bring all people back into reconciliation with God. So, brethren, when you ask yourself, why am I here today? What's this Day of Atonement all about? You can look at yourself and say, I am here to reflect on God and to be thankful for his spiritual treatment of me as an outcast. And the special relationship that I can now enjoy with God because of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. I've been reconciled to God through Jesus Christ. And I'm looking forward to the future. Well, that's going to happen to all of mankind through Jesus Christ. All will be reconciled. And that's the reason I'm here today, keeping this day of at-one-ment.